Saturday the 20th of July. Josie wakes early. It's her last morning waking up in Alex's house. Her last morning opening up the curtains and seeing the view of Queen's Park from the small window, instead of the grey, staring faces of people on the bus from her old bedroom. It's the last morning of wearing Alex's pyjamas and showering in Alex's designer bathroom and drinking coffee from Alex's shiny coffee machine. There had been a takeaway curry the night before. Josie had attempted to contribute some money towards it, but Alex had refused to accept it. "It's your last night," she said, her hand gently touching the top of Josie's hand. "It's our treat." There'd been wine from a huge glass and a TV show with surround sound audio booming through the house, and Leon curled so that his toes were gently buried under Josie's leg. Then the creak and bang and babble of a family putting itself to bed. Hushed whispers, the click of light switches, the cloud cat meowing gently from the darkened hallway, as if to ask where everyone had gone. It was, in some ways, the most perfect night of Josie's life. Josie sighs heavily. The air is limpid and sticky. Her phone tells her that it is already 21 degrees and it is only 7:30. The one time, Josie thinks, that she could really do with a disappointing English summer, and the weather gods deliver an almighty heatwave. She glances at the dress and cardigan that she was wearing when she arrived here a week ago. She pulls the dress to her nose and sniffs it. It smells of Alex's detergent. It smells of Alex's house. She showers, using Alex's spicy-smelling shower gel, and washes her hair using Alex's herby-smelling shampoo. And she wraps herself in Alex's thick, thick towels and sits on the side of Alex's squashy bed. And for a moment, she feels a wash of sadness pass through her. But then she thinks of what she has planned next, and the sadness quickly fades.
"Oh," says Alex when Josie walks into the kitchen a few minutes later, "you're back in your own clothes." "Yes." "Well, of course." She holds the worn clothes and the pyjamas in one hand, the dog in the other. "Where shall I put these?" she asks about the clothes. "Oh, just give them to me. Here." She hands them to Alex, who takes them through to the laundry room. "Thank you," Josie calls after her. "Thank you so much." Then she asks, "What time are your sisters arriving?" "Oh, 5-ish, I think, so you don't need to rush. Take your time." She throws Josie one of her golden smiles and then tears open a packet of croissants. "Want one?" she asks, and Josie nods.
Nathan comes downstairs an hour later, Leon trailing behind him in his pyjamas. Nathan eyes Josie up and down and says, "Pretty dress, Josie." "Thank you," she says, feeling simultaneously flattered and repulsed. Eliza comes in a few minutes later and starts to cry about something mean someone had said to her on Snapchat, and that is when Josie knows that it is time for her to go. She puts Fred into his carrier and slings her handbag over her shoulder. She sees Alex eyeing her worriedly. "I can drive you," she says. "It's quite a long walk, especially in this heat." Josie shakes her head. "It's fine," she says. "I'll walk in the shade. I'm not in any rush."
"And your mum knows you're coming?"
"Yes, she knows."
Alex brings Josie into her arms then, and for once Josie lets herself be held. When they come apart, Alex is looking directly into Josie's eyes.
"Please stay in touch, Josie, won't you? Get the help you need and stay in touch."
and then the milky blue door is between them. Alex and her world on one side, Josie on the other. Around the corner, Josie opens her handbag to check that it is there, the money she has been collecting all week from the various cashpoint machines between Alex's house and her job. The thick, reassuring weight and shape of it, held together with one of Eliza's pink glitter hairbands she'd found on the staircase earlier. Then she takes out the sunglasses she found under a chair in the garden this morning, a large pair with forest green frames, places them on her face, and starts walking. The sun beats down from a heartless sky as she heads towards the next place.
Part 3. Saturday, 20th of July. The house feels different immediately. It feels lighter and softer, and it feels, at long last, normal again. Alex stands for a moment in the hallway and absorbs the change in the energy. The cat sashays down the hall towards her and throws itself around Alex's legs, celebratorily, as if she too knows that her territory is returned to her. Alex gathers her into her arms, carries her into the kitchen, and puts her up on the work surface near her food bowl. "Gone?" says Nathan, peering up at her over his reading glasses. "Gone. Are you sure? Have you checked?" "No, I haven't checked, but I know she has." "Will she be okay?" asks Leon. Alex smiles at him. "She'll be fine. Her mum will get her the care she needs." But the words sound hollow somehow, meaningless. Not because she doesn't think Josie's mum would help her, but because she's not entirely sure that that is where Josie is going. It's an unsettling feeling. But she puts it to one side, because today is the day she's been looking forward to all week, and she has things to do, not least to sort out the spare room for Maxine and the boys, and the study for Zoe and Petal. Her tread feels light up the stairs, knowing that there is nobody up there on the top floor, knowing that her part in Josie's drama is over. But a small shadow remains. Josie has not stripped her bed, but has left it neatly made. The pillows plumped and fat, the surface of the duvet slick. Alex unmakes it and strips it. Josie has left the shower room sparkling clean, her towels hung straight and symmetrical from the heated rail. Alex yanks them down and adds them to the laundry pile. She pushes open the window and closes the curtains against the burning sun, which will be shining directly into this room by lunchtime. She surveys the room, and it feels almost as if Josie was never here, or if none of it really happened. She drops to her hands and knees and looks under the bed. Some dust bunnies, but that's all. And then she straightens up and runs her fingertips underneath the mattress. The key is still there, the one with the number 6 on the tag. For a moment, she considers jumping to her feet, running to the front door, seeing if she can catch up with Josie to hand it back to her. But immediately, she knows she mustn't. She knows that this key means something, that maybe it has been left for a reason. She pulls it out gingerly by the metal hoop and stares at it for a moment before putting it in her pocket. She redresses the bed, replaces the towels, and closes the door behind her. Zoe arrives first. She is the older of Alex's sisters, the smallest, the quietest. Petal is the youngest of the cousins, Zoe's long-awaited only child, conceived and born when she was 41 via donor insemination. Maxine arrives half an hour after Zoe. She is the younger of Alex's sisters and has two boys, Billy and Johnny, one the same age as Leon and Petal, the other the same age as Eliza. Maxine is the tallest and the loudest, and her boys are horribly behaved, but theirs is not the sort of family to care. And frankly, after weeks of listening to Josie describing the behaviours of her two children, they now seem like angels in comparison. Alex has set up two paddling pools in the garden and has a huge bucket of ice in the shade for chilling the wine and the children's drinks. All three sisters are wearing billowy cotton dresses, and the air smells of the sun cream that they have rubbed into each other's necks and shoulder blades. Nathan gets back from a trip to the local garden supply centre at about 6 with a new water sprinkler after discovering that the old one is dead. He sets it up, and the children run through it screaming with delight. He sits with the sisters for a while and drinks a beer, slowly, almost unnaturally so. Pacing himself, Alex assumes, for the real drinking, which will commence when he's with his friends later. She swallows back the feeling of discomfort that hits her when she thinks about Nathan's plans for the night and remembers his promise to her. She is 99% certain that he will not let her down. He loves her sisters and has always been eager to have their approval, and he knows that if he lets Alex down tonight, they will both judge him very harshly. Not only that, but she has promised him sex if he's home before midnight. She reaches out her hand at one point and squeezes his wrist with it, both affectionately and warningly. He smiles down at her and she can see it there. His resolve to do better and be better. She squeezes his wrist again and turns her attention back to her sisters. At 7 o'clock, they order their pizzas and start making the margaritas. Maxine is responsible for this undertaking as she spent 3 years working in a cocktail bar in her 20s. At 7:30, Nathan leaves. Alex follows him to the front door and puts her lips to his neck and brushes her leg against his groin. "Be good," she says. "Please." "I swear," he says. "I swear." He kisses her softly on the lips, then on her neck. And it is so unusual for them to behave like this these days, to be playful, to be sexual, that Alex feels a flush go all the way through her. She watches him from the window in the hallway, in his navy shorts, his floral print shirt, his red hair pushed back from his face by black sunglasses, and she thinks that she has missed him, that she wants him, that she is already looking forward to him coming home. And then she turns back to the chaos of her sisters and their children and the calls of, "Who wants a salty rim?" and the hot, hot sun beating down through the roof of her kitchen and onto the tiled floor.
7:30 p.m. Nathan has his phone to his ear as he heads through the back streets towards Kilburn Tube Station. He's talking loudly in that way that some people do, as if he thinks everyone in the world wants to hear his business. His voice grates through Josie's head, even from a distance. There's been a change of plan, according to the one side of the conversation that Josie can hear. They're not meeting at the place they'd arranged to meet. They're meeting at the Lamb and Flag.
"Yeah, and I'm not getting shit-faced, remember? I told Alex I'd be home before midnight. I'm on a promise."
"Yeah,"
he laughs.
"Exactly."
He hangs up and Josie stares at the back of his head in disgust. How could Alex even contemplate it? She wonders. How could she think she needed to promise him anything? Simply for him to behave like a civilized human being. She is out of this man's league in every way. Josie feels her respect for Alex wane, records another tiny degradation in her feelings for her, but then remembers what she is doing and why, and feels restored again. She follows Nathan into the tube station. She's wearing a new dress that she bought from Sainsbury's this morning. It's not as nice as the thing she bought when she was with Alex, but it's good for the heat and it's also unfamiliar to Nathan. Her hair is tucked inside a straw hat, also from Sainsbury's, and she's wearing red lipstick for the first time in her life, which makes her look even less like herself. She has Googled the pub where Nathan is meeting his friends, just in case she loses him on the tube. It's in a side street off Oxford Street, near the back end of Selfridges. The nearest tube station is Bond Street, six stops away. Kilburn is an overground tube station, and she is glad not to be underground in this heat. A breeze comes from nowhere and ruffles the hem of her skirt and cools the sweat on her neck. Nathan, at the other end of the platform, is fiddling with his phone. He's wearing shorts and his legs are skinny and pale like a child's. Once again, she wonders what on earth Alex has ever seen in this man. At least, she thinks, at least Walter was good-looking when he was young. Strong, tall, handsome. The tube arrives, and 20 minutes later, Josie is following Nathan across the chaos of Saturday night Oxford Street, where the shops are all still open and the pavements are heavy with shoppers and early diners. What a strange people we are, she thinks of her countrymen. Where other people take to the shade, to the aircon, stay indoors and close their curtains in the heat, the English hurl themselves at it, like pigs into a furnace. At a table outside the pub are three men, who all get to their feet and make baying animal noises when they see Nathan approaching. They bang him on the back and force a pint into his hand, and then squeeze up along the bench so that he can sit down. And they all look like him, or at least different versions of him. One is Asian, one is black, one is white with dark hair, but they are all dressed the same. They sound the same, laugh the same. They are a pack, she thinks, a pack of men. Men who should be home with their families, not sitting here acting like a bunch of overgrown schoolboys. There is an Italian restaurant next to the pub, with tables on the pavement. She sits down and orders a Coke and a pasta dish with fresh tomato and basil. Nathan and his friends break out into deafening laughter roughly every 45 seconds. More pints are brought to the table, and a round of shots. She hears Nathan telling his friends that he is celebrating because they have just got rid of the house guest from hell.
Oh yeah, who was that then? Says the Asian one. Friend of my wife's. Or maybe not quite a friend, but this woman she's been doing a podcast about. She got in a fight with her husband and turned up on our front step last weekend with a bashed up face. Alex let her in, of course. She's so bloody soft, my wife. And this woman refused to go home, refused to go to the police, refused to go to her mum's, just sat in our house all week, wearing Alex's clothes, with her face like someone just farted, and today she finally left. So, cheers. Cheers to having my house back.
Josie turns and watches them sourly as they bang their beer glasses together and say cheers.
Where did she go?
Asks the dark-haired guy.
No fucking idea, and I do not care. I have never felt less comfortable in my own home, that's all I know. The woman was a freak.
Someone makes another of the animal noises and they bang their glasses together again. Josie pushes her half-eaten pasta away from her. The things that Nathan is saying are not nice, but she's not surprised. She knows that Nathan didn't like her being there. But that's fine. It all just strengthens her resolve. She picks up her phone and finds the message thread she started earlier. She types another message. He's at a table outside the Lamb and Flag, the one in the flowery shirt and red hair, with three other men. Can you be here in 10 minutes? The reply comes immediately. I'm just getting off the tube. I'll be there soon. Josie sends a thumbs-up emoji and puts down her phone, a small smile playing at the corners of her mouth. 9 p.m. Josie watches Nathan's face register a small shock of pleasant surprise when the young woman stands over him and says, Can I sit here while I wait for my friend?
Oh, yeah, sure. Of course.
Nathan squashes along the bench closer to his friend, and the woman squeezes herself on the end, so that her arm presses against his. She places a drink on the table in front of her and rummages through her tiny handbag, pulls out a packet of tobacco and some Rizzlers, and makes herself a roll-up. Josie watches her turn to Nathan and say, "Want one?"
"Oh," says Nathan, "no. No, thank you, I never have."
"Do you mind if I do?"
"Not at all. Go ahead. Not a problem."
Josie can see colour rising through Nathan's face. The woman is wearing a floaty black halter neck top and tight white jeans, and her curly blonde hair is tied back from her exquisite face, which is makeup-free in the way that requires a lot of very expertly applied makeup. Nathan manages to find his way back into his conversation with the three friends, but Josie can see that he is struggling now, that he is hyper-aware of the stunningly beautiful young woman sitting right next to him, her bare arm brushing against his bare arm every few seconds. The woman plays with her phone for a few minutes, and then she swears under her breath and bangs her phone down on the table. Nathan turns to her and says,
"Are you okay?"
The woman sighs.
"Just been blown out," she says,
"by my friend.
She's always doing this. Every single time, seriously.
This is the third time in a row."
"God."
"That sucks," says Nathan. "I hate it when people do that to me."
"Yeah, it's just disrespectful, isn't it?"
They don't say anything for a moment. The woman takes a drag of her roll-up and blows it out of the side of her mouth. Nathan picks up his pint glass and takes a sip.
"I don't suppose I could stay with you guys for a bit," the woman says. "Just while I finish my drink. Seems a shame to waste it."
"God, yeah, of course, please."
"I thank you so much. You're a saviour. I'm Caitlin, by the way."
She offers him her hand to shake, and he takes it.
"Nathan," he says. "Nice to meet you, Caitlin."
Then he introduces her to the rest of the group. She shakes their hands, they smile, she smiles. They are all delighted that a beautiful young woman has joined their group. They are holding in their soft stomachs and bringing their best games to the table. Josie watches in satisfaction and then sends Caitlin another text message. "Bloody brilliant. Let me know when you've done it. I'll be waiting for you." Then she pays for her uneaten pasta and her flat Coca-Cola and heads away from the pub and into the maelstrom of the hot summer night.
10:30 p.m. Alex sends Nathan a text message. "Hi. We're being very bad. You having fun?" She watches the ticks on the message for a while, but they stay grey. She swallows down the sense of discomfort and puts her phone away. She'd been secretly hoping that he might have been home by now. The later he's out, the higher the chance of him losing himself to the night. Zoe is making herself a mint tea. She has a natural cut-off point for drinking. She's always the first to stop. Maxine and Alex are drinking the warm dregs of a bottle of Prosecco they opened earlier that had been found bobbing around darkly in the ice bucket in the garden. Petal is in bed, as Zoe is very firm about bedtimes. The other children are playing a computer game in the living room incredibly loudly, and Alex is about to go in and tell them to be quiet, as there is a bedroom on the other side of the living room wall where the house next door is converted into flats, and she doesn't want to disturb the neighbours. But for now, she's enjoying the soft edges of the night air cooling down the intense heat of the day, but still warm enough for bare arms. She's enjoying the conversation. They're discussing their upcoming summer holiday, a big villa in Croatia. All three of them, their children, the husbands, their mother, a pool, 10 days of happiness. It was booked back in January, and felt at first close enough to touch, and then, as the winter passed slowly into spring, impossibly distant. And now it is only 22 days away, and Zoe shows them the new bikini she just ordered from John Lewis on her phone, and they discuss their boobs and their bellies and their hormones and their moods, and then suddenly, it is nearly 11:30, and Zoe is yawning and making moves towards bed. Alex checks her phone to see if Nathan has sent her any suggestion that he might be on his way home. But there is nothing. She smiles tightly at something that her sister has just said. She doesn't want to have to answer questions about it. Her sisters are aware that Nathan has started binge drinking again. But Alex hasn't told them quite how bad it's been. And what hangs in the balance here, the slender fulcrum that her marriage is currently resting upon. By the time all the children have been corralled into their beds and the sisters are getting ready to get into theirs, it is midnight. Alex sits straight-backed and tense on the edge of the bed. She will wait until 5:05, and then she will call him. For now, she walks towards the bathroom, discarding her clothes in the walk-through wardrobe as she goes. And as she kicks off her sandals and leans down to put them away, she notices something in her shoe rack. A small, clear plastic bag. A scrap of napkin with a number scrawled on it, illegibly, and the name Daisy. A card holder for a hotel key card. The name of the hotel is The Railings. She knows it. It's near Nathan's office in Farringdon, a hip boutique place with all the window frames and brickwork painted chalky black. The guys at Nathan's office often use it for after-work drinks and client entertaining. Nathan has taken Alex there on a few occasions too, where they've had drinks, but certainly never taken a room. She holds the small plastic bag to the light and sees a residue of white powder clinging to its insides. She feels a dark cloud of nausea pass through her from the bottom of her gut to the back of her throat. She looks at the items again. There are no dates on any of them. They could have come from anywhere at any time. But she knows they didn't. She knows that they are from one of the number of nights that he has recently spent away from his home, away from his bed, in a black hole he claims not to remember. She brushes her teeth furiously in the bathroom, staring at the warped face of a wronged wife that looks back at her from the mirror. She's never been a wronged wife before. She has never, not in all their years together, suspected that her husband might have been the type of husband to pick up women in pubs and take them to hotels, then come home 24 hours later and pretend not to remember anything. She has never had to confront this feeling before, and it is sickening. She thinks of her sisters, who are already cross with Nathan for not being home by midnight. Imagines what they would think if they saw the things she just found on the base of her shoe drawer. Imagines the things they would tell her she should do. The punishments she should mete out, the actions she should take. And she thinks, no. She wants to deal with this her way. Calmly, rationally. Alex is not a dramatic or a reactive person. She is a person who likes to step away from situations that make her feel bad, to look at them objectively as if they were happening to somebody else, and then make a decision based on how best to keep the peace and maintain the status quo, because Alex, as much as it pains her to admit it to herself, needs to maintain the status quo. For the sake of the children, for the sake of her lifestyle, for the sake of all of them. She has too much to lose by acting in rage, far too much. She needs to give Nathan a chance to prove that her fears are unfounded, and then they can carry on. At 7:07, she returns to sitting on the edge of the bed, and she taps in his number. The call rings out.
12:30 a.m.
It is after midnight, and Josie pictures Alex in her bedroom, wondering why her stupid husband hasn't come home yet. She pictures her leaning down in the dressing area and finding the pieces of evidence she'd left in her shoe rack this morning before she left. The key card holder, the little bag, the illegible phone number with a girl's name she'd added to it. Daisy. She'd been pleased with that. The sort of ultra-feminine, young-sounding name that would set alarm bells ringing. She pictures Alex calling her stupid husband and the call ringing out. She pictures Alex's stupid husband in a loud bar in Soho doing shots and lines with lovely Caitlin. Her phone buzzes and she picks it up. It's Caitlin. We're going in. When you come in? Right now, she replies. I'm leaving right now.
Sunday, 21st of July. Alex cannot sleep. It is nearly 3 a.m., and she lies wide awake on her back, staring up at the ceiling. The air is hot and sticky, and an electric fan rustles the pages of the paperback book on the bedside table. She is simultaneously shocked and entirely unsurprised that she has been let down by Nathan. And she is humiliated that she had thought that an offer of sex might have been enough to tempt him home by midnight when, it now seems, he does not need to come home to find someone who wants to have sex with him. In her mind, she replays all the times he has expressed his disappointment in men who cheat. His friends are all good guys, he says, guys who would never do that. He has said he couldn't comfortably be friends with men who treat their wives like that. But yet, Daisy, cocaine, room number 23. She'd messaged Giovanni at about 1 a.m., who claimed they left Nathan at a bar in Soho just before midnight. Alone? She asked. As far as I know, he replied. And she knew he was lying. She wishes she was the sort of woman who kept a stash of sleeping pills in her bathroom cabinet, like in American TV shows. She wishes there was something she could do to switch her brain off. Eventually, she gives up on bed and heads downstairs. The cat is happy to have an unexpected nocturnal visitor, and Alex crouches down to stroke her. Through the glass roof of the kitchen extension, she sees a fat orange moon overhead. She imagines the same orange moon hanging over Nathan, wherever he is, whatever he is doing, possibly glowing off the soft skin in the dip at the small of his back as he moves in and out of some faceless woman called Daisy in a boutique hotel room somewhere. Alex wakes at 5 o'clock. The first thing she does is reach for her phone and check it for anything, absolutely anything, that might suggest the possibility that her husband is coming home. But there is nothing. She rests her phone on her bedside table and lies back down. The sun is coming up and her curtains glow peachy red while the house creaks and sighs as it expands back to size. She feeds the cat and drinks a huge glass of water, and a moment later she hears footsteps down the hallway and there is Petal. The shock of her niece, fresh and tiny in a blue cotton nightdress, contrasted against the dark grimness of Alex's thoughts all night, almost takes her breath away. Good morning, sweetie, she says. You're up bright and early. I always like to get up early, she says. I like it being just me. Alex nods at her and smiles, and then offers her food to eat and juice to drink. She heaves open the back doors to let out the stale night air. She empties the dishwasher and glances at Petal every now and then as she slowly eats a bowl of Special K at the kitchen table. She doesn't talk to her, leaves her to enjoy her early morning solitude. She calls Nathan. She makes a coffee. Calls Nathan again. She has no idea, none whatsoever, what she should be doing. Alex did not know it was possible for time to pass as slowly as it passes that day. She goes back to bed at 7 a.m. and sleeps for an hour or so, but is soon wide awake again, the morning sun burning through the curtains and across her body, her head full of needles of sharp anxiety and shards of fragmented thoughts. She forces herself to eat some toast and necks three espressos in a row, none of them touching the sides of her exhaustion. How long, she wonders, how long could she merely sit and wait? At 9 o'clock, she feels it is polite to call Giovanni. He picks up immediately. Gio, she says, Nathan is still not home? Please, if there's something you're not telling me, tell me now. The thick, putrid silence on the other end of the line tells Alex all she needs to know.
No, he says stiffly. No, we just left him in a bar, like we always do. There was nothing.
Well, Zoe says when Alex relays this back to her a moment later. Bro code. He would say that, wouldn't he? Alex sighs. She knows that Zoe is right. What time does he normally get back after a bender? Zoe asks. The afternoon? Well then, let's not worry until the afternoon, says Zoe. And Alex nods. But then something occurs to her and she pulls out her phone and opens up her banking app. She and Nathan have a joint bank account. They always have done, ever since it became clear that Alex was never going to be a big earner and that Nathan already was. Nathan never looks at it. He never looks at bank statements or restaurant bills or keeps receipts. He spends money on the assumption that he is roughly balancing his outgoings with his income and, for the most part, he is correct. She scrolls through the pending payments section of her online statement, looking for anything to explain where he might be, but there is nothing. Nothing since a payment to the bar in the West End that Giovanni said they'd left him in of £25.60. No Uber payments, no hotel charges. Nothing. He has disappeared without a trace. The afternoon arrives. Dark clouds appear overhead, and the temperature finally drops a degree or two. Zoe and Maxine have stayed longer than they planned, and there is a weird unsettledness in the air, as if they are in a waiting room expecting an announcement of some kind. Alex spends an hour in her walk-in wardrobe ransacking the pockets of Nathan's clothes, looking for more clues to his behaviour, but there's nothing. Her sisters offer her food, but she can't eat. She can't think. She can barely breathe. The dark clouds gather momentum, and then, at just after 4 o'clock, the rumbling begins, and by 4:30, the rain lashes down. The air fills with petrichor, and the heat finally drops. They run around closing windows all over the house. Alex calls Giovanni again, but he doesn't take her call. Her sisters tell her they have to leave in an hour. Their children have homework to do, their cats need feeding. It's a school night, and Alex realizes that the moment her sisters leave, she will be trapped in the house, unable to leave without the children, and she quickly changes out of her summer dress and into leggings and trainers and walks as fast as she can towards Giovanni's house, half a mile away. He's lying. She knows he's lying. She needs to see him face to face, to look into his eyes, look into his partner's eyes, get the truth about what happened last night. He looks shocked when he sees her at the door. He opens it a crack and then fully open with a sigh of surrender. Still no sign of him, he asks meekly.
No, still no sign. And Gio, please don't treat me like an idiot. I know something happened last night. Look.
She empties her pockets of the things she'd found in her shoe rack.
Look, she says again. These are Nathan's. I found them last night. Oh, he makes out he's purer than pure, and then I find girls' phone numbers scrawled on napkins. Bags of cocaine. I mean, seriously, just be honest with me. Was there a girl involved last night? Just tell me.
And then all the remaining puff goes out of Giovanni. And he invites her in and sits her at his kitchen table, which is covered with the debris of a family lunch. plates and dishes brought in from the sudden rain, still with splashes of rainwater on their rims. She sees Giovanni and his partner exchange a look, and then he turns to her and says, "There was a girl. But seriously, honestly, Alex, it wasn't anything, and I swear Nathan has never gone off with a girl before. I don't know who that Daisy is on the napkin. Maybe someone who wanted a job or office space or something. We talk to randoms all the time when we go out, but he has never, ever gone off with someone, I swear. But last night, this woman came and sat with us. Her name was Caitlin. She said she'd been stood up by her mate. Was it okay if she hung out with us for a while? And she ended up staying and drinking with us. And then we left the pub to go to the bar in Soho, and she came with us. But I swear, Alex, there was nothing going on with them. Nathan kept talking about you, kept saying he was married. How beautiful you were." Alex blinks slowly. She glances at her wedding ring and turns it once around her finger before looking up at Giovanni again. "And then what happened?"
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, you said you left Nathan in the bar at midnight. Did she leave too?"
Giovanni drops his gaze to the tabletop. He shakes his head slowly, but then he looks up at her quickly and says, "She was saying she was going to get him home. She was saying that Nathan told her he was on a promise and she was going to make sure he got home to, well, you know."
Alex exhales heavily and lets her head roll backwards. "He told a complete stranger about our sex life."
Giovanni nods again.
"But honestly, it was just fun, just banter. She just seemed like one of the boys, you know? She didn't seem like she was...
Like she was what?
I don't know. Like she was going to lead him astray, I guess. It just felt like one of those nights, you know, when Nathan wasn't going to stop. One of those nights when he was going to get lost to the night. And honestly, I think we were glad he had someone with him so that we could, you know, just go home."
He glances up at her sheepishly.
"I'm sure he'll be home soon," he says. "You know what he's like. He's probably home right now. Just walked in through the door." He smiles at her, but she doesn't return it. "What did she look like, this Caitlin?"
"Pretty?"
he says, his voice racked with apology.
"How old?"
Youngish, maybe late 20s, early 30s. She sighs and rolls her eyes.
"I wish you told me this earlier," she says.
"I wish you hadn't lied."
"I'm sorry, Alex," he says, picking at a bit of paper with his fingernails. "I'm really sorry."